Man, you are a busy guy. You working full time, going to master's program, and doing this before you go to work?
I probably unhealthy in a lot of ways. I feel best when I'm just like constantly moving, you know?
Sure.
It's the quiet times when I feel unsettled, but that's something I certainly am trying to get figured out, is to figure out how to be okay with not moving.
Yeah. Well, good luck.
Appreciate it.
Type A personality that wants to conquer the world. I don't think we ever kind of settle in, you know.
Oh, that's real. But how things been for you? I know obviously a lot has been going on
Yeah, we're doing
in
good.
Texas the past couple months.
Just finally kind of getting back into the normal rhythm of things. I'm not a baseball fan, but I heard that here in town, sold out 41,000 seats. I'm like, guess
Yeah.
COVID
Yeah, I saw the pictures and I was like, oh, here we go. Let's see
over,
what happens.
man. Yeah.
I know you'd meant, and I guess it would have been at least like a month or I guess more than that, geez, since we collaborated. But I know at that point you mentioned you'd rerouted some tours like two, three times.
Yeah.
I guess, are you finally getting to like settle in now? It's like, okay, these things are happening, or
Yeah.
what's it been kind of looking like?
So everybody's been watching Live Nation, and so now that they're finally kind of putting out their solidified plans, it looks like they're going to start back up in August or late July. And they're already doing outdoor shows, which was a good sign. But yeah, so we're moving everything to the fall, and just like we're just going for it. It's let's just do it and see what happens. Moving it three times is no fun, man.
Yeah, because I mean, there's like some larger shows that I have tickets to that have moved like three, four times, and they basically all punted like 2022.
Yeah.
I mean, some stuff was like stadium shows, so I get that,
Sure.
but I can't imagine trying to, yeah, reroute that stuff.
Yeah, man. I mean, some of these venues are like not even open. It's like people have had to leave those talent buying jobs and go into other fields, and so it's been quite the process. But overall, man, I feel optimistic and feel good about where we're going, it's we're all ready, man. Everybody's ready to get out,
There's going to be a boom, I guess. Is that how y'all are seeing it as well? Is people are so aching and longing for that
Yeah, dude. It's
experience?
gonna be like every night of the week. It's like Pearl Jam's here, and then Counting Crows, and then it's gonna be one after the
There's been a lot of jokes about the Roaring 20s and whatnot, but it does feel like it's a very similar setup, you know, of like 100 years ago, of everyone was pent up and then people are like, oh, wait, we do want to have these experiences, and kind of
Exactly.
just who knows how long we'll get to hang on to all of it. So,
Oh man, crazy times.
hey everyone, welcome to Made for Music. I am your host, Duncan Byerjohn. The reason I started this podcast was growing up, music was my ultimate passion, but I didn't know how to get started. So this podcast seeks to depict a comprehensive view of the music world, from the artistry to the business, so you can discover the resources available to you, and most importantly, the stories behind the people making things happen. If you dig what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. I truly appreciate that extra effort. Without further ado, here is the next episode of Made for Music. Welcome to Made for Music. Today's friend of the podcast made his foray into the music world about 20 years ago, kickstarting his talent buying venture straight out of college for local clubs in Southeast Texas. Starting around 500 to 1,000 cap rooms, he booked shows for the likes of Puddle of Mud, Seven Dust, and Hailstorm, and over the years has gone on to work with acts from Willie Nelson to Rascal Flatts to Five Finger Death Punch and the Steve Miller Band. Operating as a boutique firm, his company pre-pandemic was booking upwards of 500 shows per year, which we're hoping to get back to soon. And in recent years, he and his agency have moved into artist management as well, due to their strengths in artist development, touring, negotiations, contracts, and much, much more. So without further ado, please welcome the co-founder and managing partner of Rise Up Agency, a self-proclaimed unapologetic gear snob and coffee bean connoisseur, Richard Gandy.
It's good to be with you. You made me sound way cooler than I actually am.
I don't know. I think that I always appreciate a bit of self-deprecation, but I mean, this is amazing stuff. Like, and again, I know I said it earlier, but I'm really excited to talk about this stuff. So thank you again.
Yeah, this is great.
Yeah. And I guess before we dive in, for those who maybe, I guess, aren't familiar, do you mind like walking through what talent buying is, for those who may not be familiar with the term or the industry vertical itself?
Sure. Yeah. There's two sides to every concert that happens. You know, you've got the venue side and the artist side. And so the talent buyer is the guy who, or a person who works for the venue on behalf of the venue to negotiate the deals with the artists, agents and managers. And so everything from seeing who's routing through and then putting together kind of strategic offers and things like that. And then obviously negotiating the deals all the way to the contracts and editing things and taking the crazy stuff out of the contracts and then handing everything off on the day of the show for production and ultimately all the ticketing and everything. So it's basically the liaison in between the venue and then the artist agent.
Right on. And I guess, how does that differ from the likes of promoters? And is there like crossover there? Like, I know when you think like Live Nation, right? Build is like a big concert promoter and they're these giant marketing engines as well. How does like that compare, or is there a lot of overlap?
Yeah, there's a whole lot of overlap. So the promoter works a lot with the marketing team for each show. And so like the smaller promoters may put up their own money, and then they're investing money in marketing, investing money in obviously the guarantee of the show and then all the expenses and things like that. And then when you get to the giants like Live Nation, they're going to have everything all in-house. So they're going to buy an entire tour. They're paying the bands directly. They're paying all the marketing out of their in-house marketing department, all of that kind of thing. And so Live Nation actually manages some of the venues like House of Blues and things like that, but then they also will put up money in independent venues. And so those independent venues will have their own talent buyers kind of like working with Live Nation on the bigger shows. So it's a little different than just promotion because it's handling all the negotiating and things like that, but it works really close with the promoters.
How did you get into that coming out of college? Were you studying that at all, or was it just like, let's dive into this thing?
No, I mean, I've always loved music and played in bands and stuff growing up, and of course, trying to get the record deal and make it and all that kind of thing. You know, when that dissolved, I took some of the contacts that I had made just from booking my own band and started booking and slightly kind of managing some smaller regional acts, just my friends' bands and things like that in the area, and developed just good relationships with talent buyers in different venues regionally. And then decided I really kind of liked the behind the scenes and putting everything together and all of that. So I started doing these small festivals in college with a bunch of regional bands, and then kind of slowly started moving into, you know, could we do something bigger? And so there was a prominent talent buyer in town who I looked up to a lot named Jason Price, who kind of took me under his wing, kind of showed me the ropes and taught me how to do everything. And then whenever I graduated college, we decided we'd start our own thing together. Dove in after that, and we're still business partners today. He's one of the best guys in the whole business, and it's rare to have a partner for so long, you know, but he's done a lot to teach me how to do it. And over the years, I think we've been able to do some fun stuff. I don't have any like formal education or something in this, but street cred, I guess, is what they are, you know, learning it on the streets.
It's awesome that you had the artist experience too, doing all that stuff. Some people only ever do the artist thing, or some people like come in and do the business side, and like, because you've got that unique lens of knowing what both sides are looking for. Did you feel like that helped you as far as like a negotiation front? Like, hey, I've been on this other side. I know what is needed or what folks are looking for.
Yeah, for sure. And then fast forward many years when we started working on the artist side, knowing the venue world so well, I think put us at an advantage to be able to create offers and create deals that I knew that venues would find appealing, so that it'd be a mutually agreeable thing for the artist as well. Because you've got, everyone's going to be, you know, fighting for what they want and wanting the opposite side to get the least amount, no matter what, you know, on both sides. And I've always found if you can find that everybody's happy with the deal, then those are the most successful shows anyway. And so seeing the different perspectives is always really important.
For sure. I guess in your time you know, on both sides of both the venue side and the artist side and working with artists and whatnot, what do you feel like the biggest, or I know not necessarily biggest, but what are some of the knowledge gaps or biggest things that artists are missing when they step in, right? I think, especially maybe some first time tour routers or something like that, or if a band's doing it themselves, like, I guess, what would your biggest piece of advice be to them setting that thing up? I'm assuming probably don't come in and say you're going to headline a whole, like the whole state of Texas.
Exactly. We've picked up along the way a couple of smaller tours for artists that are independent, that they either left a major agency or have just been on their own and kind of starting out. And first thing we always ask is, well, where's your audience? Where's your fans? Like, what's the data behind where to go and that kind of thing? And in general, it's like, it's a badge of honor to be able to say you've gone on tour, you've crammed the van full of stuff and going to eat dollar menu for 2 months. And it's like, when you get back, you feel like you've accomplished something, you know, and there's, I think all bands should do it. There's nothing wrong with it. It's something that you need to go through, even just as like developing the band together and things. But the strategy behind it has been missed a lot, I think, over the years of, if we get an email saying, hey, we want to, you know, hit 15 markets across the country and we've got 30,000, you know, likes and fans or whatever on social media, and we feel like the time is right. It's just really difficult to think that you can head out and sell shows, you know, and what difference does it make if you have a full tour where you're playing a Tuesday night in Tulsa, Oklahoma, if you've got four people going to show up, you know, like, if anything, it actually works against you when you try to come back into the market later. If you come too soon, you're not able to sell tickets. So I always have thought, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000, the bands in different areas of the country were putting together these compilation CDs where they and their friends from this area would put their songs on, and then another area would put their songs on, and they trade, you know. And it was a great way. I ended up with a bunch of those CDs of finding these different bands in like Florida and Atlanta and all the way down to Texas. And then those areas you would kind of trade back and forth. I think a similar concept in going out to tour. If you can get together with bands that have prominent followings in their regions and then kind of trade shows is the way to get started there. So you can still put together a 15-date run. But let three of those markets be your strong markets and then pair up with other bands who are strong in other markets as well. Because it is rough out there. It is very expensive. It's not as glamorous as you would hope. It's exciting and fun, but, to have a good strategy behind it is definitely, the way to go, in my opinion.
Especially with like a state as big of Texas, from your lens, is it helpful when they come to you with a bill, or do you actually prefer when, like, hey, you know, we understand the market and we've got the data we can put together?
I guess from a venue perspective, most of the stuff we work on is national acts that already have a full bill put together when mm-hmm. acts are starting out and they're wanting to head out on tour. I think a strategic game plan, like I said, is a big deal. And so any act that comes and says, we've got three acts on this bill, we want to all tour together, and here's the reason why, I think is a great strategy to have. And bands starting out who can buy on tours, I mean, if you've got the money for that and the context to be able to do that, that's a great way to get started. The industry doesn't call it buy-ons anymore, but it's basically the pay to play, you know, to open for the act that's in your genre. They'll say, they call it contributing to ad cost. I don't know why they don't like to say buy-on anymore, but
it's not pay to play. You're just helping with the advertising budget.
Exactly. And if you can see it as marketing, you know, yourself and advertising, it's a little, it takes some of the sting out of having to pay to play, you know, but to get on as an opening act on a bigger bill is huge. I mean, that's the way a lot of people are finding new acts, you know. I mean, so much in the digital world, what is it, something like 60,000 songs are uploaded on Spotify every day or something like that. It's maybe that's wrong. Don't quote me on that, but that's a ton.
I was looking at it the other day.
Is it you're exactly close to right. that? Insane. I mean, how can we find any new music when everything out is brand new every second, you know? So, going and being on bills with artists that you know their fan base is going to be also your target audience is a huge strategy. I think that has worked for, you know, decades now. It's just a little more difficult because, you know, it wasn't really until the past 10 years or so artists were heading out doing headlining dates. And now, particularly in the rock genre, and now you see 8 rock artists come together to play these outdoor shows or stadiums or whatever. And obviously that's on purpose because they know they can pack out way more seats if they're all together. But some of those acts still do headlining club stuff or small arena stuff that if you really have good music and strategy and money behind you, then I think you can buy on to some of those smaller tours.
I've always been really interested about that with those like larger bands, the Hailstorms and the Buckcherry shows. And funny enough, saw a bill, it was probably 10 years ago. It was like Avenged Sevenfold, Buckcherry, Papa Roach, like all these bands that were like headliners, you know, coming together. And they did like the Tacoma Dome here, which is like 22,000 people. Are those bands actually all better off by pooling together as far as like a financial takeaway? Or is it if you're doing a 10,000 person arena, but it's like you in an opening act?
My guess is from their perspective, they feel like on their own, they could sell a certain amount of tickets. And since they all have the same target audience, if they were all together, they could sell exponentially more tickets,
across more dates.
Yeah. And so I might not want to go see Papa Roach on their own, but if they're paired with 4 other acts, I might pay, you know, X amount of money to go see it. And so I think over the years, they've also upped their production so much, particularly on the rock side, that for each one to travel and the expenses that they have to deal with on the road, if they can share those and the marketing side as well, I think it's probably a win-win. But it's left all the fans seeing, you know, those type of acts in bigger venues, whereas it was cool to see them in those 700-800 cap rooms, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, for sure. I totally see like the hedging of the bets, but yeah, there's sometimes too, I totally agree with you, where on a personal level, I'm like, I don't know if I want to go to the, I do actually love arena shows. And like you mentioned, the production being upped and whatnot's always awesome. But so if we take it back a little bit, I guess, what is establishing like an agency look like? Because I'm sure the market already had probably a bunch of talent buyers or venues or people that were in the scene. So how do you kind of come in from that like boutique agency angle? And start growing the business that way and working with like such big names? Is that partnering just with the venues and gaining that trust, or agents, or both? Or do you mind walking me through that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're not big shots at all. I will never have a building named after me. We will never be big, famous, whatever. You know, we enjoy what we do and want to do it with integrity. And I think, well, I know I could have made a lot more money over the years by cutting corners and kind of just being shady, like is allowed across this dirty industry that we find ourselves in, you know, but we chose to really want to do things above board and the right way. And I think that has been a thing that's really kind of set us apart. And it's not to say that every other talent buyer is shady and can't be trusted or whatever. It's just, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of stealing money. Mm. There's a lot of cutting corners and making deals that are kind of under the table kind of thing. And so when we come in right away and say, and we've lost some business over the years over that, of, you know, venues wanting us to do certain things that we wouldn't do. And so, you know, we've been kind of selective of who we've worked with on the venue side and artist side. But I think what we set out to do was to do something completely different. You know, our company's Rise Up. We wanted to rise above kind of the thing that the status quo of this industry that we're in, and we wanted to do that with good ethics and integrity. And so we come in wanting to have good relationships with the people that we work with, and it's not so much we want to come in and just make a ton of money, though we want to make money. It really is more about building relationships and letting the venues know, like, we're fighting for you, like, we're on your side, we're trying to have your best interest in mind and everything that we do. And so, you know, starting out on the club level, it was, and we still do club stuff. I hope we were a breath of fresh air to these guys who at the time were managing the bar and the staff and all of the stuff that goes along with the venue world. And then we come in and say, look, we can take all this entertainment stuff off of your hands. We'll be the entertainment director. We'll be the kind of consultant of all live music here. And let us know what you think. And so from there, we were able to kind of build a reputation as basically guys that are going to come in and hopefully like take the load off of these venues who are already really busy.
I hear of like talent buying agencies that aren't really doing that agency service of plugging in and alleviating. Sure. So that's awesome that y'all are doing that.
Well, we don't do it right every time, but we're trying, man.
The differentiator though is like just putting that in. That's awesome to hear, because yeah, like you mentioned, there's a lot I've just, you know, from peers heard horror stories of trying to go across the country, and you know, especially when you're far from home and starting off, it's a lot hard. You got no leverage. So
sure.
That's very cool. I guess along the way, what was like, I guess, the biggest eye opener? Like you kind of get your foot in with some of these clubs and whatnot. Did you have like an, oh, we made it moment?
I really have enjoyed most of what we've done, you know, but I figured out, because we're down in Texas and majority of stuff we've done is down here. And so, you know, country and classic rock and rock is kind of what sells. And so when I first started out, I felt like I didn't want to book anyone unless I really liked their music. And then I figured out this isn't going to work.
Right.
There's
yeah.
too much music that I don't really listen to on my own that sells well. And so started realizing that I could book them without having to listen to them, you know?
Right.
There was this movie that came out, Moneyball, like years ago, about Billy Bean, who basically put together, you know, Major League Baseball team based on just stats. And and I kind of think we've had that approach in music of I'm pretty good. Like I'm good at trivia of knowing how much artists are going to charge and then how much they're worth. And it's almost like a game sometimes, you know? And so, you know, starting to work with artists that I never followed and never listened to and all of that, but looking at the number side and the data and all of that, was eye opening at probably 12 years ago or so to realize, you could literally just look at concert history and what they're charging and ticket prices across the country and all of this and that, and be able to make a good estimate on, you know, if they're going to be worthwhile for the venue that you're working for. But I've had fun doing stuff. I've got to meet cool people and be able to, I just like looking out over the crowd when everyone's having a good time and feeling some sense of accomplishment. Like, yeah, everybody's here because, you know, we put in a lot of work to get here and it's cool to contribute, you know.
Who is, I guess, the most surprising persona that you've got to meet?
Let's see. I had enchiladas with some of the Foo Fighters one time, and that was pretty fun. More down to earth than I would have assumed that they would be. I guess you'd be surprised at some, or not, maybe you wouldn't be surprised. I was surprised at some of the wild things that the guys who are not cool do, you know?
How so?
We booked a Motown act one time. It was a small arena show, and on their rider they had, you know, these guys wanted 12 ribeye steaks, which was fine. I mean, you know, they've reached their level and that's cool. I like ribeye steak. But right below that it said these guys are vegetarians. And so night, the chef prepared 12 steaks and set them on you know, the dining area, and none of them came to eat because they were vegetarians. And I'm still shrugging my shoulders like, I don't understand the entitlement or the whatever that comes in demanding things just because you can, I guess. I don't know.
I'm like, that's so wild. Let's just give you some oxymorons here and see which route you go. Because I'm sure if you don't show up with the steaks, then they're berating you for why they're no
steaks.
Exactly. Like, well, you said vegetarian. It wasn't for us.
There's a line in most contracts that was put there, at least as far as I understand it, from the Bill Cosby days when he was touring back in the, I guess, 80s. And it's all these contracts in fine print somewhere in there, it'll say that the promoter will provide a properly tuned grand piano, regardless if they're actually going to use the piano or a lot. And they never do, because if they're going to, they're bringing their own for the most part. But we have to go through and mark that out on every contract, because the story goes, if Cosby showed up and he didn't like something and you didn't have his grand piano, he would just point at the contract and say, well, you know, you don't have my piano, so you're in breach of contract, so I'm not performing. And so they've left that in there all these years. So if an artist shows up and doesn't like something, they can go, well, where's my grand piano? And it's like, well, you know, you're Snoop Dogg. Why do you need a grand piano? I don't understand.
That is a really actually fascinating trick of the trade. It's like, oh, well, I can just easily void stuff if I'm upset.
Right, exactly.
But I guess what is some funny inclusions or even just antics leading up to shows? Have you, I guess, had an experience like that where someone's tried to like bail out of a show day of or something like that because of...
Because of no reason at all, yes. Yeah, we had a iconic country legend decide he didn't feel like playing one day. And so I had to yell on the phone for a little while, and then eventually he played. But I'm trying to think of the, we had a pretty prominent band mail themselves drugs to the venue one time. That was interesting to navigate that world of.
Because the venue's probably sitting there like, we were not a part of this.
Well, one funny thing on our rider years ago was an arena band that said that they wanted 4 slices of mid-grade salami on a plate in their shower room. And we all had a bet going what that was for. And we all lost the bet. It was apparently the guitar player takes the salami and rubs it on the strings of his guitars to make it like slick or something. I'm not exactly sure.
What?
But that was with no explanation. That was on the rider of here's what needs to happen. And so.
Oh my gosh.
We did it.
I almost feel like that's like purposely set up.
I know.
To make everyone cringe and go, oh no. And he's like, nah, it's just for my guitar. But of course, that's not explained in the rider.
Exactly. But, and the venue side can be crazy too. We had an investor one time who was wanting to do, you know, really huge shows at baseball stadium. And so we went and met with the baseball owners and tried to figure out, can we get this act in here? I mean, it holds 40,000 seats and, you know, it's going to be a big show. And they were going to charge over $200,000 just to move the pitcher's mound because, you know, we needed the grass on the field for standing and stuff. And so, right. It's like, well, I guess that means you don't want to move the pitcher mound, or maybe we should get into the pitcher mound business because that sounds insane to me. $200,000.
Yeah, my goodness, for moving a pile of dirt.
I know it. So anyway.
Very nicely packed dirt, but
even so,
wow. There was an act that came here to now T-Bone Will Park, and they had an artist that came in and demanded that the entire locker room where they were, you know, staying before going on stage had to be recarpeted. Otherwise, they weren't coming. And it was just because of the color. It wasn't like it was very nicely kept. And they basically said the cost of losing the show would have been more than recarpeting the entire locker room. And it was the home team locker room too. It was like the nice. They're like, yep, sorry, home team. We're recarpeting the entire locker room because of this one show that's going to happen here.
I don't doubt it. I don't understand people, man. Just show up and have a good time playing, you know?
Yeah, I've just... I do wonder, like, just when that switch turns in folks' brains to where they can go, like, ah, it's my time and I'm going to pick something. Or if, like, I just can't imagine being that upset about the color of a building you're going to be in for a day.
No, me either.
I know you mentioned you started off kind of in clubs. Have you mostly moved on from clubs, and are you doing more, like, small arena stuff, or do you still kind of do a mix of venues?
We did small arena stuff for a while. So we've always done the clubs, and we continue to do. Mm-hmm. There's way more clubs than there are independent arenas. I mean, and we're
right.
I mean, Live Nation's capital is here in Houston. And so they just dominate all of the larger market, you know, and some of the smaller ones. But it's pretty hard to find independent arenas, and definitely independent like sheds and outdoor spaces like that. And so we're typically still in the club stuff, but we've done a lot of the smaller arena things just by going in and with investors' money and renting out places and things like that. But clubs has been kind of the bread and butter for a real long time.
That's awesome. And not to jump too much back and forth, but really getting into the data and whatnot to like be able to really grow the business as well as just, you know, be more effective routing and whatnot. how much of your job, I guess, is also finding acts to supplement bills and grow your business by bringing on new acts?
In general, unless it's just a regional act that we're booking on a, you know, off night or something, then for the most part, we just work with what we feel like is more established acts that we know already have worth in the market. Obviously, different venues have different crowds and target audiences. And so if we're booking a country venue, then we're really looking at only country stuff, you know? And so, but even within that, there's a subgenres of the classic country or the pop country or whatever, the bro country, whatever they're calling it these days. It's like, we've got to find those new acts that are up and coming there so that we can get them right before they're too expensive to get, you know, based on the singles. So the hip hop culture actually changed the way that music influences the touring by years ago, only concentrating on the singles. And they still do today. It's like everything revolves around, if they've got a huge single, they are exponentially more money than if they had, than if they don't, you know? And so it's so fluid. You got to be up on that world, and country is moving in that way as well. Rock seems to kind of like build into a much slower audience, ticket sales and things like that, because it seems like they're still releasing full albums that are have the one or two or three singles, and then they are doing kind of the more old school way of touring where they're opening for the larger act and then eventually go do their own thing, stuff like that. And then pop is the hardest one because you've never heard of this person, and then all of a sudden they're $300,000. You know, it's like, I don't even know who they are.
So right.
We really don't do a whole lot of pop stuff because there's not really a space for pop in the smaller venue capacities, you know, like below 1,000 cap or something like that. Because seriously, I mean, a lot of stuff on the top of the charts now was not even around last year or 2 years ago, you know, so it just blows up so fast. So I don't think we look for new acts aside from the ones that we feel like are based on their releases and album release schedule are doing something that could potentially sell more tickets, because, you know, the whole booking world, we're booking right now into February. And so you've got to be looking that far ahead, but you also don't want the band to run out of steam by the time, you know, your date gets there. So of course the classic stuff, all the classic rock stuff that we've done always sells well. I mean, for the most part, and those guys are making way more money now than they've ever made in their careers, because, you know, when the Doobie Brothers were playing in the 70s, they were selling tickets for $5 a piece. And now their target audience is largely established and, you know, in their careers and have money to spend. And so they have no problem spending $400 on the ticket. And so, and they're going to spend it every time because of this nostalgic, like, let's go back to high school, you know, and relive the glory days.
Wow. You mentioned the singles, the different models basically across genres of, you know, pop's kind of whatever's literally popping off at the time, which could be a month to month thing. and then how, you know, hip hop has really influenced this, how these other genres are operating at more singles base. Do you find acts you've worked with multiple times over the years that one is more sustained than the other?
Yeah, I think once you're established and not just known for the one hit or for what's happening right then you've got a better shot if you can maintain your audience engagement to continue to make money on touring and stuff. I mean, some of these bands that have been around with no singles on the radio, with no new music, are still making great money. I think, I mean, and from the artist side, where we kind of moved in, you know, probably 8 years ago or so, putting together a strategy that goes with touring and album release is real important. And I think we see the market right now moving, and with Spotify and Apple Music and all that, moving towards primarily single bass. So like Death Cab for Cutie years ago released their album one single at a time, and then it accumulated into you know, obviously a full length. But that was kind of way outside of the box. It was an experiment, you know, let's just see if we can keep our fans engaged by doing one thing each month. And now, because of all the Spotify algorithms and all of the you know, different strategy that goes into staying in front of fans who are being bombarded with all of this new music, you know, how do you release music in a strategic way that will coincide with the tour that you're doing, and not have one before the other and things like that. So I think we're going to see all genres moving into the single world pretty soon.
Yeah.
And so we'll see some fluctuating in the guarantees and pricing of acts. But overall, if you're releasing singles in a frequent way, then I think you're going to be able to maintain your fan base, you know, more than these guys who can release a huge song and go sell out an arena, and then you don't hear from them anymore, you know?
That's awesome advice and insight. So I appreciate you walking through that, because I'm very old school in like the way I like music, which is that more traditional rollout. And admittedly, I listen like a, you know, I now, because of streaming services, I pick my favorite songs, etc. But I do love sitting down with a record. So in my mind, I've always been like, I'm going to roll out a record. And then, right, like we didn't have the engagement when we went on tour. Like we had a great time. It was hopped in and we did fine. But it was one of those that I'm definitely like, oh, if we'd done that more singles approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I'm hearing you correctly, and I don't want to misrepresent what you're saying, that really is feeding into live demand as well. Like that more continuous feed is helping actually push live sales.
Yeah. So the artist agent is going to use whatever's happening at the time to sell their act, you know, and they want to get as much money for the act as possible. So every time the act has a successful single or even a new music coming up, a TV appearance, magazine article, that kind of thing, it's any of that stuff that would be an asset based on a new single is used at the same time to try to get more money in the touring world.
Are you going out and pitching to agents and artists like, hey, here's why you should come to us as the agency? Or is a lot of times the other way around? Are folks coming and pitching you and you're determining whether or not to work with an artist and you know, route?
Yeah. Thankfully, we've built good relationships with all the major booking agencies. I mean, there's really only 4 to 5 agencies that control most of the music out there, you know?
Yeah.
And those guys move around some, but in general, thankfully we've been able to develop really kind of long lasting relationships with those agents. And so when their acts are routing through, we typically know, and they'll reach out. It doesn't mean we always get the show. It's a real competitive market. You know, we're competing with tons of other venues at the same time. And then I also just make it a practice to go through, or I did before last year, to go through and look and see what all these other venues are doing to see who we could route off new dates off of their dates. And so not necessarily in the markets we work in, but if we're looking at within an 8-hour drive, I'm constantly kind of looking through to see all the different venues that are in our size and things like that to see who we could route. And then on the artist side, I'm always looking for new artists to work with and new tours to do for them. And, but in general, we are approached by artists to say, if you have some time, this year, we're looking to do a tour, or we're looking to do an album release. You have some time to do can kind of like put together a timeline and things like that for us.
With all like the folks coming to you, is that what inspired you? Or I guess I should ask, what inspired you to move more into that artist management side and starting to like really help curate talent as opposed to staying strictly in like the talent buying space?
I think that the booking world is a good transition into management side as well, because you understand, once you understand the booking world, there's so much that goes into it of, you know, how's merchandise getting handled? What's negotiating the tour bus, negotiating all the ins and outs of a contract and all of that stuff. And so the booking world really brings, I think, a pretty holistic approach to understanding the revenue streams and stuff, because touring is the biggest revenue stream for any artist, at least in today's climate, you know. And so we just started booking a few acts that I really liked and loved their music and wanted to be a part of what they were doing. And then it's kind of slowly moved into, well, maybe we can help them merch, or maybe we can help with this. And then at a certain point, it just kind of just handed everything over. You know, I'd read this book years ago about the armor bearers back in the days of the knights, and the armor bearer would basically, like, he would sharpen the knight's swords and all of that. But his main job was he carries a shield in front of the knight, and he just knocks people down in front of him. And so as they're fighting, the knight is swinging the sword and the armor bearer is just knocking people down. And I always have resonated with that. I like the idea of being able to knock things down out of people's way so that they can do what they really feel energized and excited to do, what they're gifted to do. And I can take care of all the stuff that they hate to do, you know?
And that's really cool because it's like a true partnership in a sense. Like,
I think so.
People can really trust that, like, you know, you're in it together. And it sounds like it kind of was a natural progression. But I guess once you got to that point where, like, oh, we're, you know, going to start doing this management thing, like, what was it in particular that you looked for in artists to partner with?
I actually think a family environment or friendship is real important. And if we're just trying to make money and nothing else, I don't think it lasts as long as if you both feel like you're collaborating together to be able to be a part of something bigger than each individual person, you know? And so I've always just, or, you know, all of us have enjoyed working with people that we feel like what they're doing matters and they're good people, you know? That being said, we've also picked up tours for artists that I don't know at all, you know, on a personal level. But I know they're worth tickets and they're going to show up to the show and they're not going to like burn down the dressing room and all of that stuff. And so we'll do it. I think if I'm going to invest a lot of time and energy and effort into something, I want it to be something that matters beyond just let's sell some tickets for a while and then fizzle out. I'd like for it to be something that's kind of has purpose beyond just the initial get out there and make money. And there's a lot of those acts, you know, a lot of acts are good people and just creative people tend to not have the organization or the strategy as a strong suit, you know, that they enjoy the creative side. And so if we can come on and help them be able to create more, and then I think that's pretty valuable.
How does that look? I know you mentioned with a lot of the agency's side for the talent buying has been regional. Has the artist management side given you the opportunity to look countrywide or?
Yeah, on the artist side, we book all over the country. Well, even UK and stuff as well sometimes, but every major market across the country, thankfully, we've been able to do really successful shows and still in that 500 to 1500 capacity range for the most part. Though we've done some fun stuff. Red Rocks was fun and Irving Plaza was fun and different things. Different kind of iconic venues have been cool to work in. I don't enjoy the tour bus that much, so I like to stay home.
Yeah.
But I have gone out a few times and enjoyed the experience, you know. So thankfully I can stay home and then we can just book an entire tour and then you know, hand things off to the tour manager and they take over. But yeah, it's across the country and there's great people across every state that I've been able to have good relationships with, and it's fun to meet new people. And then even better when we can sell out a show and everybody's happy and we come back and do it again next time, you know?
Definitely. Did you get a chance to go to the Red Rock show by chance?
I did. That was a blast. Yeah.
Would love to be there.
Yeah, man, you got to do it. Yeah. It was incredible. And I don't want to do it again, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, hey, I really appreciate your time, man. I have a two more like things for you. One's just a get stumped section that I do with everybody, which is just I'm gonna throw an either or at you for preferences.
Let's do it.
Hailstorm or Buck Cherry?
Buck Cherry.
Willie Nelson or Dwight Yoakam?
Willie.
Rascal Flatts or Little Big Town?
Neither.
Hey, great answer.
No, sorry, both.
No, you're good. Five Finger Death Punch or Everclear?
Everclear.
Doobie Brothers or Steve Miller Band?
Doobie Brothers.
A blonde roast or a dark roast?
Blonde every time.
Oh, thank you. That's going to be interesting. I've been having a debate with my partner and she's insistent. That's not the way. And you as a coffee connoisseur, I'm going to leverage that till the end of time.
Shut it down, dude. It's blonde every time.
Dude, hey, well, we're going to stop that section right there, and I'm going to make sure this is on repeat while I'm editing. I'm just going to have this section going over and over. It's going to loop like five or six times. Yeah, I guess before I let you go, and I mean, you've kind of been answering this along the way, but ultimately, like, why do you work in music?
I love music. I love helping people. And I do think you can do what you love and help people in a way that makes a difference, in a way that is above board and has integrity and sleep good at night, knowing you did the best you could for the day. You know, I like building yeah. stuff. I like being creative. I like working and collaborating with people. And this has been a good run so far.
That's awesome. And then I guess on the flip side, what do you hope people you work with get out of the experience in this like musical journey?
I hope we can lift the load for people and not be a burden, you know, and come across in a way that we're wanting to be team players and let everybody feel valued and appreciated along the way. And also that we're just good at what we do and there to help yeah. and take all the burden that whether it's on the venue side or the artist side, where things that you hate, we can come in and free you up.
For sure. And I guess if we were to rewind to your college self when you were in bands and whatnot, I guess what would you like tell yourself?
Turn it up louder.
Yeah. I know you're like a self-proclaimed gear snob. Would you have any nitpicks at your band self back in the day of switching up the rig?
Yeah, you don't need a Marshall Plexi stack. You know, you just don't need it.
Yeah, I have a Marshall, oh my gosh. Since I was 18, I've had this like 4-cab Marshall that like we were playing like tiny spots.
Yeah.
And now I just have like a Fender bass breaker. But I one day I'm going to need that amp. I mean, for recording purposes, it's great. In one day, hopefully, I'll be play spots that are big enough. But I remember like loading up the car, and I was just like, "Why am I carrying this thing that at the time I needed two people to get in and out of a car to play this like 50 cap bar?" And of course, everyone's like, "You know," I walk in, the bar manager just like,
"No,
what do you? That's the whole stage."
That's my style. I love that.
Always a good time. But hey, I super appreciate you taking the time this morning. With a live music world coming back, I'm sure you've got to be insanely busy getting all this stuff back on track.
Man, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on, man. It's good to see you. Good to talk to you for sure.
Absolutely. Cheers. That was Richard Gandy of Rise Up Agency. I want to give him a huge shout out for coming on the podcast. Genuinely appreciate him taking his time amid a very busy schedule, especially as the world begins to reopen and live music is back. If you enjoyed what you hear, please rate and subscribe to Made for Music on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast medium is. Genuinely appreciate that extra effort. I hope y'all are doing well, and I will see you next time.